Welcome to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. I'm your host, Steve Stewart, and it's Tuesday, and I believe it was 48 degrees this morning or something like that. So hopefully, I know it's going to be 80, 81 today, but it's great to have the cool weather. You know, it makes you think you might have some good football in the future. So anyway, welcome to the show. Lots to go over, some breaking news to talk about. A lot of sort of breaking news. You know, sometimes we assume that, you know, when I see things on Twitter or actually see an email, sometimes you automatically think that everybody in the world knows about it right at that point. And, you know, that's just not the case. Some people are not as engaged with news as others. And so, you know, things that happened yesterday or yesterday afternoon, some people still don't know about. And so, anyway, a number of things here to talk about. Actually, something we're going to talk about today, and just at 11:20, I just got an email about 20 minutes ago. So a federal lawsuit has been filed against Leon County Schools, and not because of the reporting we did, but related to the reporting we did on an issue. And a lot more information is out now. When we did the reporting there, kept the school name anonymous, but now that's out. So we'll tell you the school that was involved with this gender transition plan that was done by the school officials without the parental knowledge. So there's been a federal lawsuit, and I'm involved with this. And so in terms of talking to Superintendent Hannah and also the parents, so we'll have this next segment, we'll go through it. And, you know, it has to do with this arcane legal interpretations and policies at the school level. You know, I think one of the things that, and we'll talk about this, is sort of the non-response of the school board on some of these issues is, I think, going to become evident in regards to how this was handled. And so anyway, we'll talk more about it at 11:20. At the bottom of the hour, 11:30, we'll talk about some local things going on here. The Children's Services Council, you know, this was a referendum-created group, and look, they're going through some growing pains, and all they've got to do is look at the city's independent ethics board to understand that just because you get the support of a lot of the community through a referendum doesn't mean it's going to be easy sailing. The ethics board has been, I think, in play now for 6 or 7 years, and you know they went through all kind of growing pains and are just, I think, starting to get things on track. Well, the Children's Services Council, who took a lot of heat in terms of, because this is a money-related thing, it's, you know, it's a new property tax to fund children's services, and so they, you know, you get a group of people together, and you start to create this organization from the very bottom. And it can be exciting, invigorating in the sense that, hey, look, we're going to try to do some good things here. But, you know, you run into problems. And one of the things they have now is, you know, they were questioned about the process, and now they've run into issues with hiring an executive director. They went through all the interviewing process, but as we'll tell you at 11:30, a couple of those people have fallen out. They were down to a final three, and they were going to make a decision, and two of the candidates have pulled out. And the one that's left, you know, is an interesting candidate in itself, and we'll go over that. But now they're faced with the decision of to re-advertise, and it will be interesting to see what happens in this, because it won't take long for this to become political in the sense that, well, wait a minute, if you had three and two dropped out, it looks like the winner is the one that's still standing. But I'm not sure if that's how it's going to work. But obviously there may be, you know, if you're that one person and you've got some political supporters, and we'll talk about who they may be, that would be the play here. So we'll talk about that at the bottom of the hour, and some other issues. We'll talk about this lot on Gaines Street that was in the news. There's a little more to the lot on Gaines Street, and I want to go through it a little bit. We'll deal with that at the bottom of the hour. And then in the last segment, we'll go over some state news. We've got a new candidate, in the Democratic primary for governor. you know, and it's sort of interesting, you know, the candidate that's getting in has ties to one of the candidates already there. The Republicans are in trouble in one of these local races about putting up candidates to sort of impact the race. This has a little bit of that feel to it, but it could, because it could really negatively affect Nikki Fried, who's running for governor. So we'll go through that. Also, we published a story about this IRS proposal that the Biden administration is pushing, where they're going to monitor these $600 deposits and withdrawals. Got a little pushback from some comments, so I followed up on that and actually talked to a banker today. And so I want to clarify some information on that. Also, this is a little bit of breaking news. The New York Post is reporting that the Biden administration is flying thousands of migrants from the Mexican-Texan border that have been captured in the cover of the night to these smaller airports, and then having them distributed into different areas. And one of those areas is just south of Tallahassee, Florida. A flight landed in Jacksonville, Florida, and we'll talk to you about that report. Now, we haven't been able to confirm their reporting, but I will tell you that the governor, Ron DeSantis, has commented on this. So they've got some very specifics on the reporting. So we've posted a story at Talos Reports on this. We'll get you up to date on that. And then also gas prices. There's a story out about the AAA projecting where gas prices are headed in the next 2 or 3 months. But, you know, I filled up yesterday, and I think I paid $3.19 a gallon, $3.29 a gallon. It was $3.9. Maddie, what's the last time you paid?
Yesterday I paid $3.19 a gallon.
Okay, so that must be what I paid. But so they're saying it's going to get up higher before it gets better. So we'll look into what their theories on that is. And also wanted to touch on really quick here in the last minute, you know, the COVID numbers. We don't hear a lot about that. We do see still some of the tracking. You know, I was a critic of how DeSantis quit publishing the county level data. Still am. I think it was really a bad decision. Given what happened, I know the numbers were down. They quit publishing it, the county level data. It opens him up to all kind of criticism. Plus, I mean, I think when you have the data, it gives you information to make your arguments based on. And he's really getting beat up for that. But having said that, now it will be interesting to see as this COVID wave diminishes. Are we going to go back and look at some of the criteria associated with the hospitalizations? We were really fixated on vaccinated, unvaccinated for a long time. But now I wonder, there are all kind of studies out there, but I wonder here locally, and in the state of Florida, if we're going to look at really who was the most susceptible to COVID, what was the impact again on schools during this last wave? Was there an increase in the number of students that contracted COVID, that actually died from COVID? That'll be an interesting thing to watch over the coming weeks. But when we get back, we'll pivot to Leon County Schools. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold here on Real Talk 93.3. Give you a little background on this, and I'm going to read some parts of a press release on this lawsuit that was filed. And I just got this today and had an indication it was coming. I know that they had tried to negotiate with the school board, but I guess they weren't getting anywhere, and I'll have to get more information on that. But we had started writing stories because we'd gotten leads about how some of these middle schools were dealing with some of the gender/sexuality issues of the students. And as you know, the most recent stuff that we've written about is related to Monford. And, you know, this boils down, there's a couple of issues here, but one of the issues is parental rights. And if you read the stories that we wrote about Monford and how they were trying to promote safe places in each of the classrooms, there's a question from one of the teachers to the person that was sort of promoting this is that, you know, what obligations, the teacher was asking, what obligations do we have to the parents in terms of sharing these conversations we have with students about this sensitive topic? And, you know, the response was, look, the response from one of the sponsors of the Gay Straight Alliance Club was, you know, that the students have a right to privacy. And so that was one of the issues that really generated a lot of traffic and a lot of concern among parents, is that you've got a student telling a teacher that she's having trouble with her gender or things of that nature, and the parents, you know, maybe they know the parents, and the teacher feels obligated to share that. So they're beginning advice from someone, I guess, they look up to, or they feel has some authority over this, that students have privacy rights. Now, this is middle school. And so if you go back to another story that we wrote previously related to middle school, which now I can release the identity of the middle school, which is Deer Lake Middle School, and is that there was a parent that contacted Taos Reports about a gender transition study or gender transition plan that was put in place by officials at Deer Lake Middle School without including the parents. And so the parent obviously was concerned about this because they were aware of the gender issues that their daughter was experiencing, and they had already gotten professional help. And so to find out that the school was actually starting to get involved with this without their knowledge or their consent was quite alarming to them. And they started asking questions and were just basically told, yeah, look, students have rights to privacy. And so they met with Superintendent Hanna, and Superintendent Hanna disagreed with that assessment that students have rights to privacy. And so from what I understand, they were trying to get the policy changed. Superintendent Hanna had basically, had verbally told the principals, look, parents need to be involved with these discussions. And evidently, they did not get things resolved they wanted to. And so they, I got sent this press release about a lawsuit. And I want to read through some of the paragraphs, and we'll comment on each of the paragraphs in terms of the implications and what it means. And we may run into the next segment. But it says here, on Monday, October 18, 2021, the Child and Parental Rights Campaign Incorporated filed a lawsuit in the Federal District Court of Northern District of Florida on behalf of the Little John family against the Leon County School Board for disregarding their parental rights by concealing from parents when their child expresses gender confusion at school. And so that's the opening paragraph. A little background here. On August 27th, 2020, the parents told their daughter's teacher about her gender confusion, and their daughter was getting counseling, and they had not consented to her changing her name or pronouns. They told the teacher only that it would be okay for their daughter to adopt a new nickname at school if she desired, but that no other changes were approved. So in other words, they were in discussion with the parents. The parents let the school know they were having issues, but she was getting help. So at that point, look, the parents are in control of what's going on here. This isn't someone that is not getting support or is not getting the mental health treatment or mental health counseling. On September 24th, which is less than 3 weeks after they let the school know what the situation was, and while being picked up from school, the daughter told her mother that she had met with a number of school staff members, and they had asked her questions, including what bathroom she wanted to use and what sex she would want to room with on overnight trips. Neither Mr. nor Mrs. Lord John had received any communication from the school regarding a meeting involving their daughter. So after engaging with the school and letting them know what was going on, they engaged with this meeting with these obviously very probing questions. And this was part of the story that we did at Taos Reports. And there was actually a part in this gender plan on exactly, how are we going to mislead your parents? How are we going to keep this from your parents? And they devised a plan to do that. In other words, when you're talking to the parents, we're not going to discuss your nickname. We're not going to talk about any of these issues. So after this happened, they were aware of this meeting. Mrs. Littlejohn contacted school officials about the meeting and was told that she could not be given any information regarding the meeting, claiming that, quote, by law, their daughter at age 13 has to be the one to authorize her parents' attendance. Now, look, I'm going to repeat this. Middle school officials told the parents that they could not be given any information regarding what was going on at the middle school with relation to their 13-year-old daughter, because by law, they have to get an agreement from their daughter. They further claimed that the daughter was protected under non-discrimination law that did not include parental notification or input. Now, look, this is actually school officials talking this way. It sounds like they've been trained in how to give this answer. And so to think that this was one teacher that was saying that, look, we don't need to talk to the parents. This is an administration. Now, this is consistent with what the teacher was told at Montford. Now, the Little Johns asked for legal authority for the school's determination that parents could not be informed of the meeting with their daughter. The school principal could provide no such legal authority, but did provide the documents the school staff had secretly developed with their daughter without their knowledge or consent. The parents were told that yet another private meeting with their daughter was scheduled for the next day. The parents told the school official to cancel the meeting. The document provided to the parents on November 2020 meeting with the school principal revealed that three staff members at Deer Lake Middle School met with their 13-year-old daughter and developed a transgender nonconforming student support plan with no notice or input from them. This document laid out school procedures that were likely to affect their daughter's psychological and emotional well-being and indicated that their daughter was comfortable rooming overnight with either boys or girls. It said that the parents were not to be notified. Now, that's quote. The document also indicated that school staff were to use a new name and different pronouns for the daughter. Now, after repeated requests for the legal justifications from the district in terms of parental rights, the parents finally received a copy of the LCS Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender, Gender Nonconforming, and Questioning Support Guide. And one of the, it says here that this guide claims that under federal and state law, parents are not to be informed when their children announces that they identify as transgender. Number two, children who express gender confusion are permitted to choose which restroom they will use, and the parents will not be notified of that decision, will have to be notified by that decision by their own children. And children have a legally protected right to keep from their parents information regarding their gender identity and steps taken by the district to affirm that identity. Now, people, I'm telling you, this is written in policy. This is the problem. And this is the concern that I've heard spoken through with Superintendent Hannah. Now, one last thing before we go to break, and we'll finish this up on the other side, is that in this document they were provided, now the press release says perhaps the most egregious violation in the guide is seen on page 15 under frequently asked questions. And this is the question. A student has exhibited behavior in a school leading administrators or teachers to believe the student is LGBTQ. Should the parents or legal guardians be notified? The answer that teachers are told is no. Outing a student, especially to parents, can be very dangerous to the student's health and well-being. Some students are not able to be out at home because their parents are unaccepting. Now, listen, you know, this is in black and white. It's in writing. These are the policies that have been promulgated by school officials. Now, the question is, where is the school board? And that's one of the things I'm going to address when we get back after this break. We'll finish up with what the lawsuit is looking for here and some more parameters of that, and then find out where we are with this. So stay tuned. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
All right, welcome back to Above the Fold. we're discussing this federal lawsuit that was filed against in the Northern District of Florida on behalf of parents here in Leon County against the Leon County School Board regarding parental rights. Has to do with basically the policy that's been stated numerous times that middle school students have rights to privacy from their parents when it comes to gender issues. And just real quick, let me read this question. This is one of the Q&As in the guide presented to school officials. A student has exhibited behavior. This is a question. A student has exhibited behavior in school leading administrators or teachers to believe that the student has gender issues. Should the parents or legal guardians be notified? And the answer that they've been told, officials have been told to give, is no. Outing a student, especially to the parents, can be very dangerous to the student's health and well-being. And so the parents have filed this lawsuit through a group called Child and Parental Rights Campaign. And they say here in the press release, attorney Mary McAllister states that school officials cannot continue to ignore the direction of parents concerning their minor children's mental health and well-being. Parental rights are amongst our most venerated constitutionally protected rights and are critical to the integrity of our public school system of education. The Child and Parental Rights Campaign, which is following a lawsuit, is a nonpartisan, nonprofit public interest law firm whose mission is to defend parental rights and protect children's well-being against the impacts of gender identity ideology. And so, you know, I think a couple of things to be taken away from this is that they're not hiding. This is not like they're suing the school because a teacher sort of misinterpreted the policy. They, from what I understand, have been in constant, or not con, they've been in contact with the school system trying to get this ironed out. And this is policy of the Leon County School District. And now I understand from what my discussions with Superintendent Hanna is that he is, you know, verbally said this is not what he agrees with. But the question is now, is where is the Leon County School Board on this issue? And the thing is, I haven't heard, you know, and I guess I haven't done a good enough job of trying to round up comments from school board members, and I'll continue to try to do that. But, you know, from what I understand, this family tried to, and I hate to use the word negotiate, but they tried to get these policies changed. And now Superintendent Hanna told me that this was in the process, but look, this is almost a year ago now. And I don't know that there's been any policies changed. And if you look at what we uncovered at Montford Middle School, it seems like nobody's following the verbal direction of Superintendent Hanna, or at least they're not getting that, because this whole thing on parental rights and privacy protections for middle schoolers in regards to this issue was just echoed from officials at Montford Middle School less than a month ago. And so this lawsuit is, obviously is in response to the lack of action from Leon County schools. And, you know, the thing about this is I think, and, you know, I have been a little frustrated in trying to understand the exact authority of the Leon County School Board, or any school board for that matter, because, you know, the superintendent is the operator. And, you know, we were told a couple of times during this COVID debate that a lot of the final decisions were up to Superintendent Hanna, despite what the school board voted. For example, this last thing about taking the mask away or providing a mopped out for mask, there was a vote which was 3-1, but that was more just a resolution, because Superintendent Hanna had already made up his mind and was going to do what he was going to do. So I'm really not sure exactly what the authority they have. I've always viewed it as the school board making policies that needed to be followed. Well, that would clearly fall in this realm, the policies regarding gender issues and you know, what takes place in a middle school. So anyway, this will be interesting, and this will be, obviously we'll get discovery if this goes to court. Could take a long time. Maybe this will speed up negotiations with the Leon County School Board. And we'll obviously follow up and get comments from the people involved. So, all right, that took longer than I wanted, but I think it's definitely a detailed story with a lot of nuance, which is my favorite word these days. And so we'll see where it goes. Now, I want to pivot to one other local issue before we get out on this segment, and that has to do with the Children's Services Council. As I talked about in the opening, look, starting these new organizations is very difficult. A lot of unforeseen problems popped up, and that's what's happened here. I mean, if you remember, the Children's Services Council is going to get these, I think it's $8 to $10 million a year to go to Children's Services. Part of the initial controversy was actually the property tax itself that overwhelmingly passed in our community. Okay, next step, trying to identify, the big debate was when to identify your priorities. So they said, hey, look, we're not going to do that until we hire an executive director. All right, so we do a nationwide search on an executive director. We get it narrowed down to three potential candidates. And all of a sudden, when you're getting ready to hold the meetings for these three potential candidates to do your final interviews, two of them withdraw. And that leaves you with one candidate, and you're left to figure out, how is this going to look if we just go with the candidate that is left standing? And then you say, okay, well, we're going to look at new applications. But then the point's going to be, well, wait a minute. You've already selected the top three. So now do you re-advertise it? And then you're starting to think, well, wait a minute. If we don't hire the person that's left standing, is this going to be a negative reflection on her? And as I said earlier, the politics is getting ready to start to kick in here, because if you're the one that's left standing, and we're not talking about this job, I think is going to pay. Well, I know it's going to pay six figures. And so, the question would be, hey, look, I made the final three. The other two bailed. It looks like it's me. I win. And so you've got to be asking yourself, well, who is the person that's left standing? Well, that individual is a lady named Sika Rose Green, who has applied, and she has a very interesting background. She is currently the regional executive director for Children's Home Society of Florida, the Big Bend region. However, before she took that job, which they don't have the date on here exactly when she took that job, it says here, prior to joining CHS, Green served as the director of special events / chief of information for the Andrew Gillum for governor campaign. So that was 2 years ago. So she's only been at the executive director for the Children's Home Society for 2 years, minimum. Now, it says here, that was on her resume, prior to joining the CHS, the Children's Home Society, she was the member of the Andrew Gillum campaign. Additionally, she's a CEO / chief strategist at Truby Rose Strategy Group, which was founded in 2018. Now, I haven't looked that up, and I'm not sure what they do there. But if you go back, and she's got her list of past positions, one that does ring a bell to me, and that does say that she's the vice president director of communications for P&P Communications Incorporated. That is the formal company that was founded by Andrew Gillum. Doesn't say how long she was the former director of communications for P&P, but if you do a little research, we wrote a story on Talis Reports back in 2017, and the title of that story is Mayor Gillum's Gubernatorial Campaign Paid Rent to His PR Firm. And the PR firm at question here was P&P Communications. And so, look, I don't know, and I would assume, although I'm not sure, there's nothing in the record here. I know that Talis Reports mentioned that she worked, not Talis Reports, the Talis Democrat mentioned in her bio that she worked for the Gillum campaign, but there was no discussion about her role with P&P Communications. But, and I'm going to hold it here, because I don't want to look like that there's issues with this candidate. But I would say two things raise a tremendous red flag here. First is that she's only been with the Children's Home Society for 2 years. Second, she worked on the Gillum campaign. And third, she worked with P&P Communications. Now, I went back to look and see if she made any comments on the Gillum campaign. And I will tell you that, you know, obviously Gillum lost by, I think, 33,000 votes. And she was quoted in a news article. And obviously she was despondent about Gillum losing, but you can tell that there's a political bent to her comments. She says, "I just wonder if we're really a country of inclusion." She says, "If we're really a country that says no matter from where you come, what your circumstances is, if you work hard, that you can achieve the American dream." She goes on to say, "It was a hard-fought campaign. We fought a lot of negative ads. There were a lot of racial attacks. And growing up black in America is hard enough as it is. It's kind of disheartening." Now, my question here would be this. Is her background more geared towards what we're looking at the CSC, or is it more politically driven? We'll continue to look into that. But the Children's Services Council's got a tough decision facing it. And it's unfortunate because they tried to go through this process the right way, and then two people bailed on them. So, all right, we get back. We'll turn our attention to some state issues. I'm Steve Stewart. You're listening to Above the Fold.
If it's local and it matters, it's Above the Fold with Steve Stewart on Real Talk 93.3.
I remember standing on the corner at midnight.
Just appreciating the Bob Seger tune here. Welcome back to Above the Fold. All right, we're going to pivot to some state news. As I said earlier, you know, a lot of times the news is slow to getting some people because they're not as engaged as other people. And I am really focused on sort of local and state news, and sometimes the national stuff just flows right by me, and really don't. Sometimes I'm late to the party on some big stuff. But anyway, on the state side here, you know, there's a new candidate running for governor on the Democratic primary side, and this is an interesting thing. The candidate is a state senator named Annette Taddeo, who jumped into the race on Monday, saying she's a candidate who can excite voters in her party's bid to oust Republican Governor Ron DeSantis next year. Now, like I said, she is a Florida senator, state senator, but she was also governor, or Chris's running mate, Charlie Chris's running mate, when he tried to recapture the governor's office in 2014, and Chris lost to Governor Rick Scott. So, it's interesting. There was a lot of back and forth on this announcement between Taddeo and Chris, all positive. Taddeo, I have tremendous respect for Charlie. I love Charlie, and I know he has a huge heart. However, and then, you know, Charlie, Chris, in response, "I know and respect Annette Taddeo. We share a common goal of moving Florida forward and away from the negative and divisive politics. However..." What you don't see is a love fest with Nikki Fried. And, you know, so the question here is Charlie Crist, I know he obviously didn't recruit her, but are the Charlie Crist fans looking to get some help from Taddeo, whose base is South Florida now? She is from Columbia, so she would have some of the Latin America appeal, where Republicans have done so well down there. Is this gonna take votes away from Nikki Fried, who that is her base? And remember where Charlie Crist is from? He's from Tampa. So now we have two candidates running in South Florida. Is this just a coincidence that a woman with a background from South America is getting in to the Democratic primary race? When there's another woman from South Florida who that would be her base, Nikki Fried, is running. Now, so, you know, it will be interesting to see, but this is something that's definitely going to change the tenor of the race. Because remember, this, you don't have to have a majority of the voters in the primary. It's a plurality. And this is how Andrew Gillum won 2 or 3 years ago. There was a race full of Gwen Graham, Andrew Gillum, and there were a couple other candidates in that race, so that when the final numbers were revealed, Gillum had he had under 40% of the vote, but he was the one that was declared the winner. Gwen Graham, you know, people would say if it was Gwynn Graham against Andrew Gillum, Graham would have won that and would have went on to face Charlie Crispo. That's not the way it's done in Florida. It's done that way in some other locations, other states, but it's not done that way here. So now that you have this Taddeo, who is in the race, now you will say that, well, she doesn't have a lot of statewide recognition or statewide name ID. She doesn't need it. She does have name ID in South Florida. She's been an office holder down there for a number of years. And so this is, that's where a lot of the Democrat voters are in South Florida. And so, listen, definitely a concern, got to be a concern for Nikki Fried's candidacy. And so we'll have to see what happens. You know, the thing here, what might happen is this might open up the gates for other candidates to get in. So what would be funny to see if you see a male candidate from the Tampa Bay area get into the race. And so we'll keep an eye on that. So this definitely will make the primary more interesting, and we'll keep an eye on that. Now, another issue that I wanted to address was we did a story a while back, a couple weeks ago, maybe a week ago, where the Florida Bankers Association came out against this new Biden IRS proposal where would require information be reported regularly, tracking withdrawals and deposits of $600 or more. Now, there were some comments on there saying that look, this is just a precautionary measure to deal with tax fraud, and your name's not going to be connected to this. Now, look, I did a little bit of research, talked to some banker friends, and there are right now, if there are suspicious deposits of over $10,000, the name who have associated with that deposit is forwarded to federal officials. From what I understand, what they're saying is this is the same thing that's going to happen, is that this banking information will be tied to specific names. And so this will be an issue. And we'll see. I don't know where the legislation is, if it's tied up into the infrastructure bill or also some other legislation, but this is something that banks are against because of the extra cost and the expenses that they would have to go through to deal with it. Not to mention the implications for people. You know, you're talking about cryptocurrencies becoming more popular. Now, I don't know a lot about cryptocurrencies, but this would be something it seems like that people could move to avoid having to deal with this if they don't want to deal with it. But anyway, wanted to give you an update on that. And also something that came out last night, we've got a story up on Tosh Reports now on this, and this is the New York Post is reporting about the process of resettling migrants from the Mexico-U.S. border. Now, evidently, the Biden administration is taking some migrants that are captured crossing the border illegally, and they are distributing them through throughout the United States. Now, the manner in which they're doing this is what I think is getting a lot of people's attention. The New York Post is reporting that about 2,000 migrants that were captured have arrived in New York in White Plains, New York. And what they're reporting is that the way this is, the process is that the Biden administration is taking these migrants under the cover of night in airplanes and going to airports and then having them resettled from these airports. And it's not real transparent. In other words, what the Post is also reporting is that late Saturday this past weekend is a plane landed in Jacksonville, Florida, and about 15 to 20 people were seen in the cargo terminal there, and they were resettled. These are migrants, and they were resettled in a location 130 miles west of Jacksonville. Well, that'll get your attention. And so from what the Post is reporting is that they were resettled in Twin Oaks Academy, which is located in the Apalachicola National Forest. The academy is owned by Twin Oaks Juvenile Development Incorporated, a nonprofit which was established in 1998 and is based in Tallahassee. And so they're providing them, various levels of services. Don't know how long they're going to be there. But the Governor Ron DeSantis commented and said that, look, if the Biden administration is so confident that their open border policy is good for the country, why so much secrecy? And basically, they're arguing that they haven't shared a lot of information here about this. Now, the New York Post goes on to argue from an opinion standpoint that they're doing this because they don't want voters to know what's going on. We'll keep an eye on this and get more information on this issue to you. We'll obviously be back on Thursday. But until then, have a great afternoon. Enjoy the cool weather. And we'll see you on Thursday. I'm Steve Stewart. You've been listening to Above the Fold.
Gonna be bright.